Which that, that rule of construction takes precedent over ambiguity and leaping out into other indicia of intent.
Voter intent. Absolutely it does. But I think we will get to indicia of voter intent because I do not think that there's a disharmony by reading 432 and 15.3 together.
Tell me why you don't think that.
Well, number one, I do not think that whether a district attorney is a state officer is somehow an essential characteristic, that it's simply labeled by statute, or even, and in fact it's not obvious in this, that in 432 that the district attorney is not also a state officer. It's not necessarily exclusive, and I think there are many indicators that a district attorney is in fact
Mr. Schrager, I'm just concerned. I mean, a district attorney is elected in a county. We have 17 counties. They're elected in a county. They're paid by the county. How could they possibly be considered a state office, like a state constitutional officer or a state assemblyman or state senator? I'm just curious about that.
And before you answer that question, let me just tag on the rest of it, because under Article 15, Section 3, Sub 2, it makes a specific point. It says no person may be elected to any state office when it has or local governing body. So it makes a distinction. If everyone's a state officer, why are they putting that second piece of language in?
I would not disagree with that. In fact, I would concede that there is a distinction made. What I will not concede is that a district attorney is, by his nature or by labeling in 293-109, is not a state officer, or even by his or her inclusion in Article 4, Section 32. In fact, I think that the basic question you're asking, Justice Gibbons, is a very simple one. Is a DA a state officer, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think yes. But let me hasten to add, I think that depends upon the angle you come at that question and the purposes by which that analysis is made. And I don't believe that the lists or the enumerations in 293-109 or 281-010, or Article 4, Section 32, are determinative of the question for a term limits analysis. In fact, for every indication in those particular listings or enumerations, the respondents can give you saying, this should close the case. I can offer examples as to why that perspective should shift a bit. Characteristics of a DA's office, functions, duties, that shift that individual into a state officer context. And other courts, and I'll be happy to talk about them, have seen this as well. Here are some of those examples. NRS 228-120. The Attorney General, obviously a state officer, exercises basically plenary supervisory authority over all district attorneys and the discharge of their public functions, can require of them reports, can, in fact, take over cases from a DA. Seen that way, the DA is, in some senses, a branch of a wider statewide law enforcement body. Think of it this way. Let's say I leave this courtroom, and in a fit of pique, because my performance didn't go very well today, I go back to my hotel room in Reno, and I destroy the place. I go down to the bar, and I get in a fight. Very properly, the Washoe County District Attorney will file charges against me.
Might be the city attorney if it's a misdemeanor, though.
Could be. If it's the district attorney, he will file that on behalf of every citizen of Nevada, not simply the citizens of Washoe County. The caption of that case will be State v. Bradley Schrager. I hope never to find myself in that situation, but that's what it would be. District attorneys are invested with that authority on behalf of the entire state. Well, I didn't think much of the residency issue at first when I first encountered this case, but now it seems to make sense to me. In Montero, this court said, for a district court judge, the proper unit of residency for whether that judge can run a particular judicial district isn't the district, it's the state. But this court didn't do so simply because it ran across 293-109, saw the district judges were listed as state officers, end of case. It engaged in an analysis of the functions, jurisdictions, all of those things, in order to arrive at that.
The district judges are state officers paid by the state. They're not paid by the counties. And so I think that might be part of the nexus. I mean, I see we have a lot of district attorneys here. Mr. Gammack's district attorney of Washoe County, he can't go down and file charges against somebody in Clark County. I mean, his jurisdiction's Washoe County.
But when he acts on behalf of all Nevadans. And I don't know that the specific jurisdictional limits of Mr. Gannett's abilities to file charges make him only a county officer.
And well, he acts on statewide laws that have been passed, and in that sense, you're correct, but I think it's a little bit of an overstatement to say he acts on all people, acts on behalf of all the people.
And no different than a JP who the cases are entitled State of Nevada versus John Doe, and we supervise JPs even though we're state elected officers, and JPs are certainly county townships.
Certainly. What I'm trying to illustrate here isn't, because I do not think there's a hard and fast answer either in 432 or 109 or any of the other statutes, is that there are ingredients which lend credence to the notion that this court and the Attorney General and the Secretary of State understood the ballot initiative in a certain way. Well, let me also bring up, one, there would never be a Montero-like case in the district attorney's context because district attorneys are specifically excluded from residency requirements in that particular statute. They could come from anywhere in the state. There's a reason for that as well. Does that not lend some credence to the other side of their Janus-faced or dual personality as state and perhaps county officers? Let me also say this. District attorney's offices get sued all over this country, oftentimes in federal court. What's the very first defense they raise? The 11th Amendment. And courts across this country have granted 11th Amendment immunity to district attorney's offices as arms of the state. There are splits, 4th Circuit, 5th Circuit, sometimes within a circuit, depending on the specific circumstances within a state. And I don't know exactly how an 11th Amendment analysis would play out here, and that's not before this court. But district attorney's offices have, in brief after brief, made the argument that we are arms of the state for the purposes of the 11th Amendment. Now, I don't know this. I have faith that faced with multi-million dollar liability, the erstwhile district attorney's offices here may in fact be tempted to make the same argument. I think that the fact that there's the temptation to call oneself an arm of the state in one context but not in another lends some credence to the fact that there is a hybrid situation here.
Mr. Schrader, for me, the academic question in this case is whether this court should modify its standard of review for initiative petitions and examine or consider the explanations that are offered as part of the ballot questions in interpreting those provisions as necessary to that question. First, do you maintain that there's a conflict between the language that was used in the amendment and the description? And if so, why should this court alter its statutory and constitutional rules of construction to some other form of construction?
Justice Hardesty, direct democracy and popular initiatives are strange animals for courts charged with interpreting them. They aren't like ordinary legislation. We don't have the vetting process, the committee process, the minutes. We don't even have drafters' intent. Sometimes these ballot initiatives are drafted with the help of legislators and professionals. Sometimes they're drafted at someone's kitchen table in the middle of the night. That's the beauty of them, but it's also part of the problem for courts interpreting them. There is a fork in the road when courts come to interpret ballot initiatives. There is no drafter's intent. There is no legislative intent. There is only indicia of voter intent, which is a very difficult thing to nail down. But I think that the court, that the Alaska Supreme Court in Alaskans for Common Language, which I cited in our supplemental authority, puts it very well. When we review a ballot initiative, we look to any published arguments made in support or opposition to determine what meaning voters may have attached to the initiative. And further, to the extent possible, we attempt to place ourselves in the position of the voters at the time the initiative was placed on the ballot, and we try to interpret the initiative using the tools available to the citizens of this state at that time. And as the California Supreme Court has said numerous times, voters should get what they asked for, nothing more and nothing less. There is some interplay in what the voters asked for, in what the voters were asked to pass upon. In this instance, it seems very clear that, at least from the condensation, voters who walked into that booth thought they were voting for term limits for state and local public officers. So the question beyond that is a district attorney's office the kind of office that voters thought they were limiting at the time? The United States Supreme Court in McMillan, and this is cited in appellant's substantive briefs, this was in the 1983 case, found that Alabama's sheriffs, all 67 of them, may I proceed, Your Honor?
Yes, go ahead.
All 67 of them spread across the state, locally elected, within districts, that in their law enforcement capacities, sheriffs were state officers, not county officers. They were merely dispersed, but acting as law enforcement officers, they were officers of this state. It seems to me that voters in 1994 or in 1996, which I'm sure you will remember was a sort of paroxysm of anti-incumbency, a period we seem to be entering again, or at least stuck in the middle of, what were the ways in which voters encountered district attorneys? Well, number one, through their law enforcement capacities, the very same capacities that the United States Supreme Court called sheriffs, state officers. And number two, as political candidates. Every few years, voters, at least in Clark County, I don't know about up here, are bombarded, just like any other office, with ads, mailers, television commercials regarding the political office of district attorney. It seems to me that the indicia of voter intent here would seem to include district attorneys. I'm not necessarily saying that it meant to include all possible local elected officials. As the court recognizes in one of its orders, there may be an examination of exactly which offices ought to be included. It seems to me that the office of district attorney, given the ways in which people encounter it, the ways in which voters would have understood this initiative, would be included among their number.
Thank you. I'll give you 2 minutes in rebuttal, and Mr. Eisenberg, I'm going to give you 17 minutes. Certainly, I'm sure that the court would like to hear a weird version of Montero, since you did argue it in front of us, so as to how it would have application or not application in this matter.
I will, Your Honor. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Robert Eisenberg appearing for the respondent, and I'm also handling this argument on a pro bono basis, like Mr. Schrager. I'd like to start, if I may, by reading a very brief quote from a 1940 case by the Nevada Supreme Court as the Gilbert case. And the court concluded by saying, in the case at bar, appellant was elected by a vote of the people. He should not be ousted unless clearly ineligible under some constitutional or statutory provision. What that quote reflects is a public policy that runs throughout every issue in this appeal. And that public policy is based on what this court has recognized as two very fundamental, important rights. First, the right of any citizen to hold public office. And second, the right of voters to vote for the people they want to hold those public offices. And this court has said that those two rights cannot be limited unless there's some clear and unambiguous constitutional or statutory provision that makes the office holder ineligible or that should restrict the right of the voters to elect who they want. Now, counsel stood here and the very first thing he told you was that the constitutional provision at issue here could be interpreted in a certain way. But it could also be interpreted in another way, although we contend that it's clear. But he says, well, it could be interpreted in a certain way. If a constitutional provision can be interpreted in more than one way, reasonably, then that provision is ambiguous. And if it's ambiguous, the rules of construction that this court has established for more than 70 years is that the ambiguity has to be resolved in favor of the office holder, and the ambiguity has to be resolved in favor of the two rights that I mentioned, the rights of people to hold office and the rights of voters to elect who they want. And so the rules of interpretation require it to be resolved in our favor here. He mentions the fact that district attorneys file
unless the court examines jurisprudence from other jurisdictions, and frankly, a number of law review articles which advocate for a change in the rules of statutory constitutional construction for initiative petitions. Would you care to comment about that?
Well, I'm not sure what they're advocating for, but as counsel correctly mentioned here, when you have an initiative petition, you don't really have a body of legislative history. There is some guesswork involved. So you apply normal rules of constitutional interpretation, one of which is that you have to harmonize two provisions. And as Justice Pickering pointed out, there's another provision of our Constitution that clearly says a district attorney is a county officer. And so you have that provision, and then you have another provision that says there's going to be a term limit on state officers. A district attorney can't be both. The Constitution says he's a county officer. So even if we apply some other rules of interpretation for initiative measures as opposed to provisions passed by the legislature, I think you still get to the same result here, because the overriding consideration is that you can't interpret one provision by ignoring another. The question of whether a district attorney is a state officer is answered by case law, by the Constitution, and by statutes. And the case law is Miller versus Burke, which, Justice Gibbons, you wrote just barely 3 years ago. And in that case, a Board of Regent members said, I'm not a state officer. I'm not subject to the term limitation provision. And this court said, no, you are, because of two reasons. First, we look at the statute that defines and lists state officers. And second, we look to and adopt an Arizona case that defined what state officers are. The statute in Nevada that lists state officers listed a Board of Regent members. And the Arizona case law says somebody is a state officer if they're elected by voters throughout the state or by any political subdivision of the state greater than a county. So under either test, a district attorney is not a state officer. He's not listed in the statute that lists state officers. And he's only elected by the voters in the county for which he serves. So Miller versus Burke answers that question. Then there's constitutional provision that says a district attorney is a local officer, answers the question. And then there are numerous statutes, at least five or six, that refer to district attorneys as local officers, including the statute that sets their salary. There's a statute for replacement of district attorneys. State officers are replaced by the governor. If a district attorney, if there's a vacancy in a district attorney office, that replacement is done by the local board of county commissioners.
Mr. Eisenberg, I understand your argument about state officers, and really my question was different. There is a suggestion here that the description of the question in 94 and 96 is at variance with the language in the constitutional amendment itself. The description, at least by my count, three times, informs the voters that the purpose of the amendment would limit the terms of state and underlying local officers. That appears in 94 and in 96's description of the amendment. And my question then is, to the extent that the court would determine that there is some ambiguity present in the language of the Constitution itself, would we look at the voters' intent by examining the descriptions which appear to be at variance with limiting only to state officers, but rather inclusive of local officers as well?
The title of it, or I don't know if you would call it the title, but the very brief description is, in fact, somewhat broader than the actual constitutional provision. The genesis of that, well, first, actually, before I get to that explanation, I want to emphasize what you just said, is that you only get to this point if you conclude that the constitutional provision itself is ambiguous. If it's unambiguous, you don't even have to get to that point. But the genesis of that mistake, if you would call it that, or that mischaracterization of the constitutional provision, was actually the ballot initiative itself. And if you look in the supplemental appendix that we filed, it shows the question 9 initiative. And it's entitled, An Initiative to Limit Terms of State and Local Officers. But the language of the actual provision is not that broad. It's only state officers and local governing bodies. Now, what happened is that in 1994, the Secretary of State on the ballot adopted, for the most part, the broad language that was used in the initiative petition and said that it was for state and local officers, even though it was only state officers and local governing bodies. And then in 1996, the same thing happened. So the genesis of it was some broader language that started in the initiative process. So the question then is, was there enough confusion? Do you take a constitutional provision and change its meaning to comply with an erroneous description in the ballot measure? Or do you leave it alone and assume that the voters looked at the actual language of the constitutional provision? And that question is answered in that Herbst gaming case, where there was some argument that the anti-smoking initiative was ambiguous. And this court said that any voter who had any question, all that voter had to do is look at the 1.5-page provision itself that was attached to the ballot. And then in Miller versus Burke, this court also talked about the legislature's contention that there was some ambiguity created by the question that might have caused voters. And what the court said is, the legislature's contention presents us with the unenviable task of determining whether voters were confused or misled by the ballot question when they approved it over a decade ago. The legislature has not provided us with any evidence, much less evidence beyond a reasonable doubt, that voters were indeed confused or misled by that language approximately 12 years ago. Without strong evidence showing that voters were confused or misled, to now determine in hindsight that they were is nearly impossible. Well, the same thing applies here. Here we are 15 years after this was enacted, and now for the first time, we have actually the court raised it sua sponte. The appellate didn't even raise this issue in the district court, the fact that there's some ambiguity between the title of the ballot on the ballot and the actual language.
And in fact, the evidence is not that strong on the two ballot initiatives, because the explanation lists the categories of officers to whom this would apply, and district attorneys are nowhere mentioned in either 94 or 96. So if you read the whole explanation, it's questionable whether it amounts to strong evidence.
That's correct. And in fact, it's not just the explanation. It's also the argument for passage and the argument against passage. The argument in the explanation, it says, other state officials and local governing body members would be limited to 12 years. Then the argument for passage three times talks about state officials. The argument against passage refers to state office holders and members of local governing bodies. So although the little blurb at the very top is a little broader than it should have been based on the Secretary of State borrowing language from the initiative petition, which itself was wrong, otherwise, it doesn't. There's no indication that voters were misled or confused. And what's the remedy? If the voters were misled or confused by a blurb at the top that was too broad, is the remedy to interpret the Constitution in a skewed manner to cram it into the incorrect blurb, or is the remedy to throw it out and tell the proponents of the initiative measure, you've got to do it again, and this time you've got to do it right? Now, nobody here is suggesting that the term limitation provision that's been in our Constitution for 15 years should be thrown out. But that's really what I would suggest should be the remedy, not to change the Constitution to make it comply with an otherwise erroneous title.
Mr. Eisenberg, on this Article 15, Section 3, Subsection 2 in local governing bodies, is there any way that could be interpreted as meaning anything other than like a city council, a board, a county commission? Carson City has a board of supervisors, or like other library boards and school boards and things like that.
Well, first I would point out that the appellant never raised that in the district court. His only contention is that a DA is a state officer. The Attorney General answered that question in the 1996 opinion number 23, which specifically dealt with what is a local government body. And what the Attorney General said, and by the way, your opinion in Miller versus Brooke adopted that Attorney General opinion. And what it said after exhaustive research from around the country is that a local governing body is a group, and I would equate that to like a student body, which is a group of students. It's a group whose function is to govern. And the Attorney General's opinion said it is clear that county officials such as the recorder, assessor, and district attorney are not members of governing bodies, and that the term limitation petition will not limit the terms of service of district attorneys because they do not perform legislative functions as part of a local governing body. And I respectfully suggest to you that the Attorney General's position was right on based on legitimate research. A district attorney, number one, is not a member of a body, and number two, he's not a governing body because he doesn't create legislation or create policy. He enforces it. And so there really is no legal basis, and I would suggest that the court should not even consider that issue sua sponte since it wasn't even raised in the district court. Unless the court has any other questions, I would just like to close by pointing out that like the appellant in the Gilbert case 70 years ago, Mr. Mallory was elected by vote of the people, and he should not be ousted unless clearly ineligible under some constitutional or statutory provision. If the proponents of Question 9 15 years ago wanted it to apply to every elected person in the state of Nevada, they could have easily said that. They could have easily said that there's a 12-year term limit for any elected official in the state. They didn't do that. They limited it to state officers and members of local governing bodies. And there's probably a good reason why they didn't apply to every state official, because in many of our rural counties, there aren't very many citizens. And in many of our rural counties, it might be very difficult to find people who are qualified and willing to run for a local office. And if you interpret this provision to be so broad that it applies to all public officials other than judges, or that it applies to all local elected officials and not just state officers or local government bodies, then it could create havoc in our rural counties. And I suggest to you that that's why the proponents of this provision limited it, and limited it only to state officers. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Eisenberg.
Mr. Schrader, 2 minutes with them.
Very briefly. First of all, let me say this court assuredly did not adopt the 1996 Attorney General opinion in Miller v. Burke. I argued Miller v. Burke, and had you adopted it, I would have won that case. So that did not happen. Let me say this. I think both sides agree, or it's come close to agreement, that there is ambiguity in this provision. In fact, at the bottom of page 14 on to 15 of respondents' supplemental brief, one reasonable interpretation is that the terms do not include local officers other than governing board members. Another plausibly reasonable interpretation is that the terms include all state and local officials. That's their words, not mine. The question then is, what do we do about that? That's what I understand to be your question, Justice Hardesty. Now, the presumption of eligibility, in the presence of ambiguity, eligibility for office should carry the day. I think that's fine if we're talking about substantial compliance with filing regulations. I think it's fine if we're talking about murky questions about where someone lives in regard to a residency determination. It's quite different when the question at stake in the provision itself is whether or not you can run for office, whether or not you can be elected. But let me say this. If we're going to have direct democracy and ballot initiatives, there must be some way for us to deal with this problem, which is people go into the booth, maybe they have their sample ballot, maybe they don't, they're confronted with a question. I don't think it's proper for us simply to throw up our hands and say, you got a bill of goods. You thought you were voting for one thing, you get another.
Counsel, so how do we deal, though, with general versus specific? You're talking in general terms and sweeping terms, opposed to the voters understanding we don't want that particular office holder in for this time. That seems to be what we're confronted with. How do we determine that when we don't know what all those individual voters thought?
This is the difficult situation that direct democracy puts this court in, and it puts courts around this country in that same problem. And the best you can do is look at the arguments, look at the information like the Alaska court did, put yourself in position of a voter in the booth, armed with that information at the time, right, during 1994 and 1996, during a sort of highly anti-incumbent period. Certainly, it's very difficult and highly unscientific for this court or anyone to determine a sort of head count of voter intent. These are merely indicia of intent. But I think it has to be taken into account if we're to confront a problem like this. And if I can make one more final point, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
Having to do with the footnote 38 in Burke, which is really, if you look at the district court's order, that's what he based his decision on. Footnote 38 in Burke controls. And this is the Rosenberg footnote. But the court at the same time said that I have some problems with this and some concerns, but as a lower court, I'm going to follow this court's precedents. I would urge this court to look back at footnote 38 through the lens of a term limit analysis for district attorneys in this context, because number one, as the district court said, footnote 38 seems to allow a state statute to control interpretation of a constitutional provision. Secondly, the Arizona case. I think if you look more closely at it, the facts and circumstances of the Shumway case are simply not applicable, and I'll state it this way. And don't get the impression that I don't think the opposition on the Board of Regents is or isn't a state office. I think it is. I think the result is right. But the idea that the definition of state officer coming out of a case that had to do with who you sue in an election contest, the Secretary of State or the local elections official, the idea that if voters outside of one county vote for someone, that makes them a state officer. I'll note for the record that there are 13 regents in Nevada. 9 of them are elected only by voters within Clark County. Back to Article 4, Section 32. This raises the notion, if the legislature can consolidate, abolish, change district attorney's offices and duties, you could conceivably consolidate 2 of the smaller counties' district attorney's office. Would that, under Shumway, make that particular district attorney a state officer? Would it change the status of a Clark County district attorney.
Mr. Shrew, can you explain that to me? Because I kind of missed that point. There's 13 regions, and 9 of them are by Clark County, or what did you say were?
9 of the regions out of the 13 are voted on only by individuals within Clark. Their districts are only within Clark County.
Are you talking about the assembly, then?
No, the regions. Yeah, the regions.
The regions, okay.
We have 13 of them.
Okay.
9 of them are wholly within Clark. Nobody outside of Clark County votes for them.
Thank you.
But the point about consolidation, would the consolidation of 2 counties up in northern Nevada make a Clark County district attorney a state officer when there's been no change to his duties or status or anything else? And what I'm trying to suggest is there's a significant amount of play as to what makes or doesn't make someone a state officer. And the idea that someone can be a state officer or a county officer, but there's no overlap and nothing in between, doesn't ring true to me. So I would urge you to overturn the district court.
Thank you, Mr. Schrager. Thank you, Mr. Eisenberg. And thank you both for serving pro bono. We appreciate this for the fine arguments from both of you. We expected it, and you lived up to at least my expectations. Thank you both. This case will stand submitted. We'll be in recess till 1:30.
All right. Thank you.